You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Saturday, August 11th, 2018. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs, and I thank you for joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. Please also visit and subscribe to spingolaspeaks.net and woolliesblog.blogspot.com. And screeningsandyhook.net. Now, at spingolaspeaks.net, you will find the archives, you will find book recommendations, health information, and all kinds of things. At Screening Sandy Hook, you will find a lot of articles, talks about the victims there, talks about the open casket funerals, talks about a lot of things that people really have never heard much about. During the program, email questions or comments to comment@spingola.email. I invite you to visit the chat room at spingola.chattango.com. You may view our guest lineup at spingola.com. That means that you will be able to see, well, all the people that have ever been on the program since I started back in 2010, with interesting links to their subject or to other subjects that are relevant. And so do visit spingola.com and click on the radio schedule button on the left, and find out about our guests and past guests. All right, we will take calls in the third hour at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420 Cannabis, Magical Herbs and the Occult. You may find out about Chris at cannabisculture.com/content/author/Chris Bennett. Chris Bennett has been researching the historical role of cannabis in the spiritual life of humanity for more than a quarter of a century. He is the co-author of Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana Magic and Religion, which was printed in 1995. Also, Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible in 2001. And he is the author of Cannabis and the Soma Solution in 2010. And the book that I just referenced, which was just published in 2018. He has also contributed chapters on the historical role of cannabis in spiritual practices in books such as The Pot Book in 2010, Entheogenics, or Entheogens, and the Development of Culture, 2013, Seeking the Sacred with Psychoactive Substances, 2014, One Toke Closer to God, in 2017, Cannabis and Spirituality, in 2016, and Psychedelics Reimagined, in 1999. Bennett's research has received international attention from the BBC, Guardian, Sunday Times, Washington Post, Vice, and other media sources. Last week, my guest said that it seems that there is a new mind-altering substance in use with each generation, and it seems to lead to a disconnect between the generations and that they do not relate to one another. In other words, children fail to relate and appreciate their parents and their experiences. Chris, welcome to the program.
Well, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, your book is terrific. It is very, well, it's heavy. It's 775 pages long, including the index. And when I was in a speed reading class in college, well, 777, 777 pages. And my speed reading teacher in college said, a book without an index is no good.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to see that you have an index and a bibliography and all the things that contribute to having a good book. Plus, the information is amazing. It's just amazing. You're a wonderful writer, and you're a scholar. You are a scholar on this subject.
Well, I'm flattered that you think so. I definitely try to, you know, I make some pretty controversial suggestions and claims in Libra 420, and so I want to be sure people understand where this information is coming from, the sources of that type of thing, and that it's not just stuff I'm making up as I go along, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I appreciate that. And let's start, well, at the beginning. And you talk about cannabis and religion in the ancient world. And we hear so much about cannabis now and with different states making it legal and various applications of cannabis and cannabis oil and CBD infused oil and all kinds of things. But this is not the first time that cannabis has been used. Certainly.
Absolutely. You know, people think about cannabis history and they maybe go back to the 60s or the jazz age maybe with Reefer Madness, but cannabis, you know, according to Carl Sagan, he thought it was probably humanity's first agricultural crop. And evidence of cannabis in archaeological terms, according to Elizabeth Whalen Barber, who was probably the foremost expert of Asian textiles, tools used for breaking up the fibers of the hemp stalk to make for cloth and rope and things like that can be seen back as early as like 25,000 years. There's evidence of hemp rope in the similar time frame, about 23, 24,000 years. Evidence of hemp cloth simultaneously in Taiwan and Catalhoyuk in the 10 to 12,000 year range. And from a find in the Ukraine region of about 5,500 years ago of a polypod bowl that was used for burning cannabis inside of a cave where they'd be able to hold the fumes in, we've certainly had an ancient relationship with it just from archaeological standards, not to suggest that this find is the first ever time a person used cannabis, probably it had been in use for some time, just the first archaeological evidence of it goes back 5,500 years, which is, you know, before any of these existing religions or things like that. It was definitely used in a shamanic type of context.
Wow. And of course we know that what we refer to as the founding fathers, grew hemp and used it for documents and for a lot of things. And we understand that, one can make clothes out of it. So it was a good product. Now, there is a difference between hemp and cannabis, correct?
No, you know, like, hemp is just actually a term like cannabis for the cannabis plant. And the distinction that there's an idea that it's a different species, that's like just not the case at all. It can be hybridized like any plant for specific purposes, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And due to regulations, people were seeking low, really almost non-existent THC type of strains of cannabis with just a minimalist amount of THC present to meet standards for industrial hemp, but it's still the same plant. And, you know, generally when you're growing it for fiber, you want a plant that has got long stalks and where the fibers are, and you grow it very close together, maybe 100 plants in a square meter or something like that, you know. And then if you're growing it for flowers or seeds, then you want it like one plant every a few feet. So it has room to grow branches and buds and seeds, and that type of thing. So it's grown for different purposes, and specifically, you know, what you're seeking out the best for whatever purpose, right? So, it can be as varied as a Chihuahua or a Great Dane, you know, and that's the situation with cannabis. But it's cannabis and hemp, it's all the same thing. Initially, the term Indian hemp was used to, distinguish from the European hemp, the more psychoactive type of varieties, because they had noted in Europe that the cannabis there was not very psychoactive or psychoactive at all from what they could perceive, but they were hearing tales of a very similar plant when they were traveling into India and places like that, and they thought maybe it was a distinct plant, but they ended up terming it Indian hemp. But if you took hemp from Europe and you place it over in these hot regions, after a number of generations, it would take on a lot of the similar qualities of the cannabis that they were talking about. So a lot of it's like hybridizing, climate, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. True, and that makes sense. Now, in the beginning, you mentioned the Theosophical Society founder, H.P. Blavatsky.
Yes, that's right.
And tell us a little bit about her. She was... Well, she referred to hemp or to cannabis, and
Well, Blavatsky, you know, she's a very fascinating figure, and she was a real pioneer, not only in women's rights, part of the suffragette movement, but also a pioneer in bringing ideas from the Eastern religions over into Europe. And she was hanging around with a lot of people in the occult scene, figures like the well-known occultist Gail Rawson. And Rawson and her traveled around the Middle East together and were initiated into a number of esoteric Islamic sects and consulted with all sorts of interesting individuals in their times in the Middle East, and were lifelong friends. And Rawson said that Blavatsky had been at one time a regular user of hashish, and that she said it multiplies one's life a thousandfold, and that she recalled previous incarnations and stuff under its use. If that's the case, in later life, Blavatsky may have come to reject it somewhat, you know, and I think this is like a common scene, theme I've seen with a lot of the early experimenters, you know, like they were victim of their own cultural baggage in some respect, but it was hard to say, like, was this an artificial paradise, or was it something that really took place because you ingested something and you had the experience? Did that disavow the spirituality of the experience? And this may be something that Blavatsky struggled with. And I've seen this happen with other people, particularly, say, Charles Baudelaire, a member of the Club de Hashishin, who coined the term artificial paradise after his own experiences, which were initially very enthusiastic with cannabis and opium, but he eventually became addicted to opium, and I think associated the same problem with his use of hashish, which probably had more to do with his ill health, probably had more to do with his consumption of opium and absinthe and other substances that he was using as well. But yeah, there's sometimes remorse there, and she's not the only occultist who had a mixed relationship with cannabis.
Now you mentioned opium.
Yeah.
There is a big difference, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Opium, you know, is, an incredible painkiller, but at the same time, overuse of opium is going to lead to physical addiction, right? Both of these substances were becoming increasingly popular in the 18th, 19th century after Napoleon's escapades in Egypt and elsewhere. More trade of these things filtered in, and they often traveled together, right? You know what I mean? So you might, you know, just like people selling illicit drugs, sell combinations of different things, that some are quite deadly and some are quite harmless, like cannabis. So there was a predispensity for them to travel together, and in some cases even mixed together, you know, and this is not only true in 19th century Europe, but also in the Middle East, you know what I mean? Often other substances were mixed with hashish to add to its potency, not just opium, hembane, mandrake, darnel, and other substances.
Wow, it's interesting. And of course, we're aware of the opium wars, the two opium wars.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And,
terrible stuff, yeah, I'm definitely not advocating any experiences with opium for anybody, but cannabis, you know, and, its history is really fascinating in the whole occult scene, not just Blavatsky, the whole French occult scene was blasted with the stuff. Figures like Louis Alphonse Cagné and Pascal Beverly Randolph, all sorts of Rosicrucian initiates were all experimenting with hashish, usually in conjunction with magic mirrors, and that's a practice that goes back to probably at least the Renaissance period.
Oh, explain these mirrors.
Yeah, well, one of the things I take a look at is the 16th century grimoires, Sefer Raziel, Liber Salomonis, and the Book of Magic and Invocation, which has recently been republished as the Book of Oberon. And both of these grimoires, and grimoires were these magical texts that were passed around kind of like magicians' workbooks, and they had to be written out by hand to be copied, right? So each one of these surviving grimoires was a handwritten manuscript that was a working text that was used by magicians. And in both of these grimoires, the recipes for cannabis ointment mixed with other plants to be used in conjunction with magic mirrors, which are these dark scrying mirrors that people would see visions in. So they were like not reflective in the sense of a mirror that you might comb your hair in, but there were these black, almost deep black forces, often made out of obsidian or something like that. And they would just stare into them until they began to see visions. And the cannabis apparently helped the visions. And this was a combination that we can see continuing on into the 19th century, as I mentioned.
Now, we often hear that cannabis is a gateway drug. And what are your feelings on that?
Oh, I think that, you know, an argument can be made as a gateway away from hard drugs. There's all sorts of people getting off of opiates and hard drugs by using kratom and cannabis and other plants like that. So I don't think that's really a valid argument. You know what I mean? If anything, the prohibition of cannabis by placing it into a marketplace with hard substances like that, might put it into that area where people might come into contact with it, right? That's why legalization of cannabis is such an important issue.
And I do believe that it should be legalized. It is a natural plant. And
you know, that's where I really draw the line is, you know, I would advocate for any plants, even the poppy, you know. Raw opium is not as addictive in the sense of something like morphine or heroin or these extracts of it, right? And I think that humanity has a natural right to the plants of the earth. You know what I mean?
Oh, I do. Absolutely.
And when we're talking about a plant like cannabis, you know, we're talking about the historical use that, like I said, goes back to like 30,000 years. You know what I mean? These are the earliest, you know, this is like during the period of the Great Leap Forward when humans really started taking on humanity and culture and things like that out of that period forward. And agriculture, you know, led to culture. So, if, you know, it's our first cultivated crop. It's played a pivotal role in that, you know?
Right. When I was growing up in California, there were poppies in my yard. And now, when you hear the word poppy, you automatically think of drugs. And but I do believe that the plants are there for humanity and for the benefits that we can obtain from those plants.
You know, if you're suffering from pain and somebody in the ancient world, poppy was a godsend. It was worshipped as, you know, something sacred in the ancient world because of its ability to, you know, primarily deal with pain and also offer altered states. There's poppy goddess images that go back thousands of years.
Wow. Alrighty, we are going to a really quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. And it's really just an amazing book, all 777 pages of it. And you talk about it being in the Bible, and that the implication is that by using some herbs that are natural to the earth, that we can become closer to God, and that this is a beneficial thing, not only spiritually, but for health purposes. And I personally believe that the reason that several things have been criminalized is because Big Pharma can't make any profit on it.
Absolutely. You know, we know in areas where the states have had legalization initiatives, some of the biggest sponsors of the fight to dissuade that, you know, against that legalization has come from Big Pharma companies.
All right, we are back. Our guest today is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. And we're talking about kratom. We're talking about CBD. And could you explain what CBD is? It's a cannabidiol.
Yeah. You know, if you want to talk like medical cannabis, I don't want to proclaim that I'm any sort of expert in regards to medical cannabis. What I know about is more, you know, cannabis history and that type of thing. But CBDs, you know, one of the active chemicals in cannabis that people are attributing a lot of specific relief from, as opposed to the type of effects that you get from THC, which is also medical but has more profound psychoactive type of effects. And most of my research has been about the more psychoactive type of effects of cannabis in history, rather than the industrial fiber and protein-rich seeds and things like that. So I'm probably not the best guess for going into the medical aspects of the plant, although I know about the history of the plant.
Okay, and of course you're familiar with Rick Simpson, who was cast out of Canada for doing something that was really good.
Yeah, well, Rick, you know, he spread his message worldwide now because of it. You know, what we're seeing here with legalization coming is a lot of the pioneers are being kind of forced out of the industry, and there's basically an attempt for some sort of corporate takeover of the whole thing, which is very unfortunate. But hopefully we see laws adjusted as doors open, you know, and we're still fixing liquor laws a century after alcohol prohibition, so I'm sure we'll be messing with the cannabis laws and intricacies of all that for a generation to come.
Well, I'm not exactly, I don't think that the people that supposedly represent us actually represent us at all. I think they have a lot of people who are putting money in their pockets, who are, getting the legislators to go with the corporations, and for the betterment of the corporations, the financial benefit of the corporations, rather than the benefits of the people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we definitely have to have room for people to be able to grow their own medicine and provide their own cannabis and things like that, and room for all sorts of levels of trade in it. You know what I mean? From the craft level on up, you know?
Right.
There has to be room for everybody, or it's just not any, it's not legalization. It's just, and you know, and they're finding in California that still huge numbers of people are buying off of the black market for the very reasons that we're discussing.
Wow. Excuse me. What about the Magi? You mentioned them.
Yeah, well, Zoroastrian magi generally associated with the Zoroastrians. They're a very interesting culture when it comes to cannabis. The Zoroastrians religion, it gets its name from Zoroaster, their main prophet. But prior to that, he was a reformer of an earlier religion known as the Mazian religion. And they had a sacrament known as Heoma, which is related to the Vedic religion's famous psychoactive religious beverage, Soma. That both these cultures come from the same earlier source. And we know that now that in the regions where this cult originated, in what's known as the Bactria-Margiana Archaeological Complex, which is in the outer regions of Afghanistan. There's been the discovery of 3,000-4,000-year-old temple sites. And these temples were about the size of a football field. And half of these sites were dedicated to the making of a sacred beverage, according to the Russian archaeologist who's responsible for their discovery and analysis, Victor Serianati. And he says that this Heoma was a preparation of cannabis and ephedra, and then in some later cases, cannabis, ephedra, and opium. Zoroaster grew out of this same cult. He said to have reformed the Heoma cult and repressed it somewhat because it was known for these all-night orgiastic type of rituals. And you got to remember that ephedra is the raw source of methamphetamine.
Oh, yes. Sounded familiar. Yes.
And so if they were mixing in, ironically, ephedra is still used in modern preparations of Heoma. And Zoroaster was a reformer of these religious rites. And but we know from later Zoroastrian texts that he continued the use of cannabis, often preparing it by mixing it with wine, and also in some cases mixing it with Heoma, which would be this now denatured form of Heoma, which would just contain the ephedra and not the other admixtures, cannabis, and then, as I mentioned, in some cases opium was claimed to have been used as well. They use very potent extracts. They would make these alcoholic infusions with cannabis infused into wine, like the hashish infused into wine. And they would drink a number of cups of it. And these potent infusions, according to accounts in Zoroastrian texts, were so potent they'd knock somebody out for a couple of days. And many of the visions that they had under the effects of these potions, in the case of Ardu Virat had said in his voyage he had witnessed the splendors of heaven and saw the evil suffering in hell, and this would later filter in to Christianity. As well, another important Zoroastrian figure, King Vishtaspa, said to be Zoroaster's first convert, who converted to the religion, it is said, after consuming this cannabis-infused wine. He had a vision of the end of the world. This was known in Rome as the Oracle of Hystaspes, which is the Roman version of Vishtaspa. And the Book of Revelation is thought to be closely related to this same text. You know, it's important to remember. Book of Revelation, John at the beginning of it takes a scroll and he eats it. It turns to taste sweet in his mouth. He swallows bitter, and then he begins to prophesy. So there's some indication. Something was ingested in that case as well. But in these Zoroastrian accounts, it was recorded as a cannabis-infused wine. And so very interesting and profound cosmological implications, you know. And, you know, it's interesting that this find that I mentioned earlier, the Bactria-Margiana Archaeological Complex, it's related to, there's been some debate about Serenati's claims and the analysis done there, but it's been verified by some other interesting finds that are related. There's another culture that was intertwined with Persian culture, the Scythians in the Persian region. They were known as the Saka, but they were part of the wider Persian cultural complex. They were known as the Hail Mabarga, the Hail Gatherers is what that name means. And they were super nomadic, highly, skilled horsemen and did lots of traveling around. And we know the Scythians burned cannabis because we found in an ancient tomb, remnants of little teepee-like structures, that they would cover in a carpet, and then they would bring in a brazier with hot rocks and throw cannabis on the rocks and then stick their heads inside the teepee and inhale the fumes.
Mm.
But more recently, they found golden goblets that were used, according to the Russian archaeologists involved with the find, to drink Haoma, the beverage I mentioned earlier. And in the residues from these goblets, that they found the residues of both cannabis and poppy opium. This is all related to a fascinating archaeological discovery in central China going back to about 2,700, 2,800 years ago. This is the find of Indo-Europeans that were living right in central China. They're known as the Gushi culture. They were there from about 2000 BC to about 400 BC. And at several of these sites of tombs of shamanic-like individuals that were buried with, tools implementing a high priest or shaman or something like that, they have found cannabis, female specifically, flowers of cannabis at these sites. And we know these guys were in trade with the temples in the Bactria-Margiana archaeological complex because artifacts from either culture has been found at either site. So they were a part of a huge trade route. And the Scythians I mentioned before with the golden goblets were skilled horsemen and highly nomadic, served the purpose as intermediaries of trade between the
sure.
two regions.
Wow. Well, as you were talking, I was thinking about Native American culture, where they would all get into a teepee and smoke something.
Yeah. Well, even the tobacco prior to the arrival of Europeans is that would be a whole different product, really, than the tobacco and people smoking cigarettes. And, could be highly hallucinogenic. Numbers of cultures use forms of nicotine for its, psychoactive properties. It's a very common plant used by shamans in North America and South America as well. When we're talking about the peace pipe, we're not talking about, passing around a cigarette. There's a much more powerful type of effect that was taken from that really strong type of nicotine tobacco that they used to use.
Right. And of course the manufacturers have made cigarettes very addictive and lethal and not at all what the Native Americans used to smoke. Now you mentioned the Nag Hammadi Library.
Yes, document.
Yes. Lots of documents.
Well, this is where I go into the suggestion of this biblical use. I should probably explain some of that.
Yes.
There's the Hebrew term cannabosum, and it is in first appears in Exodus 30:23 and appears in a number of other places later in the Bible. And Sula Bennett, who was an anthropologist and etymologist, suggested first in 1936 and then again in a later essay in the 70s that this Hebrew term was actually a reference to cannabis that had been mistranslated when the Hebrew was translated into the Greek and then the mistranslation followed later into the Latin and then into the Lingish. It was mistranslated as calamus. Now, even amongst Hebrew scholars, there's debate about what this term cannabosum is. It's not just calamus that is suggested. Some suggest lemongrass, some suggest some form of cinnamon, other people suggest other things. Sula Bennett based her argument on following the history of the modern term cannabis and its counterpart in the later Hebrew Mishnah and other documents as cannabis back through, said that this had developed out of this earlier term cannabosum. And it's certain that the term canna and cannabosum in the Bible, refers to something that's seed-bearing, that can be used for fiber and other things from the distinct references it holds. And in the first of these references, another really important thing to remember also is there's this word in the nearby Assyrian language, the counterparts of the similar time, that we know from Assyrian documents that has been identified as cannabis, kanabu, and is very phonetically similar sounding and was used in an identical way as to that which we find in the Old Testament text. And, you know, in the first of these references to Cannabis and Moses, who should be remembered, first perceives the angel of the Lord in flames of fire from within a burning bush, is connected to make a holy oil with about 6.5 pounds of this Cannabis mixed with myrrh and cinnamon into about 1.5 gallons of olive oil. And this is the holy oil. And every time that Moses is to speak to the Lord, he's to go inside this small tent-like enclosed structure, known as the tent of the meeting. He's cover himself in this oil. THC's fatty soluble. Your skin's a big organ. Go inside this hot, closed, enclosed, tent. And then he's also to put some of this oil on the altar of incense. And then he speaks to the Lord in the pillar of smoke over the altar of incense. The pillar of smoke actually refers to as the Shekinah. It's actually a feminine word, but it refers to the physical presence of the Lord in the tent of the meeting. And the other Israelites, they never see or talk to the Lord, but they know Moses is talking to the Lord in the story when smoke is pouring out of the tent of the meeting. So it's pretty smoky in. And it takes a lot of smoke for the Lord to come back with answers. So this is a really profound situation when you consider a psychoactive substance like cannabis. And in this respect, it should be mentioned that even the substitute, calamus, which is likely, you know, some mistake from some scribe, it's not like everybody translating was an expert botanist. They were dealing with lots of words and lots of things, and it could well have just been an honest mistake. It doesn't necessarily mean there was a conspiracy to hide it at this point. It's an interesting when you follow these Hebrew references through the Old Testament, as I first did when I wrote my book, Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible. I spent 5 years with another friend of mine who has a master's in religious studies and speak Hebrew. And we went back, you know, into source language and things like
that. Oh my gosh.
Over a 5 year period. And when you take a look at these other references, and they appear in Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Isaiah, a really fascinating story begins to unfold. And, you know, in Ezekiel, it's described as coming in as an item of trade. And that's interesting because the term canna, which is the root of cannabis, is the old Indo-European word of the Scythians and the Indo-European groups I mentioned earlier. And as an item of trade, it was traveling on these same trade routes, same things the Scythians were bringing down into the Bactrian Marginal Archaeological Complex. These trade routes extended right into the Mideast. And, you know, what we know now is that the Silk Road was as much of a hempen highway as road. It was an item of trade of rare spices and herbs, and cannabis was one of the most prized of these type of ingredients in the ancient world, particularly by the temples, because it made the worship so much more interesting and enthusiastic. I reference in Isaiah, Isaiah's lambasted for not having enough of the canna.
Oh my gosh, I have read the Bible several times, and I never got any of this out of there.
You have to know what specific references to look for.
Sure.
You know, like, it'll have calamus or fragrant cane in there. You have not brought me any cane for sacrifice, you know. But you have to go back and know where these specific references to cannabisum that Sula Bennett was the first to suggest were references to cannabis occur. But by the time of Jeremiah, one of the later prophets of the Bible, it's completely fallen out of favor. You know, like Jeremiah has the Lord say, what do I care from your canna from a distant land? Your sacrifices do not please me, you know, and it's condemned. And this is likely, you know, due to the religion going from kind of like its shamanic origin, say in the desert with Moses, who's also almost like the shamanic leader, goes into the tent and comes out with the message from the Lord, you know.
Back. Okay, well, we'll hold that thought. We'll be right back. And our guest is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, magical herbs and the occult. Now, when one belongs to a 501c3 corporate church, I'm a former member of a church, but we were taught to see what the higher-ups in the church wanted us to get from the scriptures. And I think that I may have missed quite a lot. And
well,
I know that...
You know, it's a convoluted history, right? You know?
Yes.
And there's a lot to it.
And the entire Bible is an arbitrary compilation of books that didn't include everything that was certainly available.
And yeah, the Gnostic, for one.
Yeah, go ahead. Yes, the Gnostic Gospel of Philip.
Yeah. One of the main points, like, okay, I should go a little bit more about this anointing oil I mentioned in Exodus 30-23.
Yes.
And I was saying that it kind of fell out of disfavor by the time of Jeremiah, you know. Mm-hmm. But it reappears in the early Christian period. And the term Christ itself is the, you know, Greek counterpart of the Hebrew term Messiah, which means the anointed one. It makes a reference to the run that received the anointing oil. At the time of Moses, it was limited to the high priest, but in later events, it was extended to the kings in the, you know, the line of David, the Messiah kings were all anointed. And Jesus, as a claimant of the line of David and a messianic king, his name was applied to him, likely for these same reasons. And in the Bible itself, you know, Jesus never is described as baptizing any of his disciples. But in the oldest of the synoptic gospels, Mark, he sends out the 12 with holy oil to cast out demons and heal the sick. And casting out demons in this time period could mean things like the treatment of epilepsy. Epilepsy was thought to be demonic possession up until the medieval period, you know, and we have cannabis recipes that are believed to be for the treatment of epilepsy in Assyrian texts much earlier than this time period, and later again in the 16th century with figures like the alchemist Paracelsus, who had an arcanum of cannabis that was used to treat epilepsy. What we might consider medical cures may well have seemed very miraculous, you know. Topical cannabis is very effective for a variety of skin diseases and has some antibacterial effects that are even more potent in some ways than antibiotics. And have been used as such through history. So, you know, leprosy in the biblical text can refer to a variety of skin diseases, and cannabis may well have been very effective for some of these. Other events of miraculous healing as well. But it's in the distinction between groups we now know collectively under the blanket term of Gnostic, as represented in the Nag Hammadi Library text, which is a series of documents from the first few centuries to about the 4th century A.D., that were found in the Nag Hammadi region of Egypt, which are Christian documents.
Right. Okay, we will be right back. It's the top of the hour. Stay with us.
Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth. Truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, cannabis, magical herbs, and the occult. And we were talking about the Nag Hammadi Library, and which also included the Gospel of Thomas. And we're talking about the Bible. It was just an arbitrary collection of books, and a lot of things were left out, and they were just, it kind of makes you wonder what was left out. And now the Nag Hammadi Library was found excuse me, in Egypt in 1945.
And one of the main points of contention between what became the Roman Catholic Church and these different Gnostic sects, and I should remind everybody that this is a term that refers to a variety of different groups with some similar beliefs, but different variations of them, right? And this term refers to literally probably more than a dozen different sects that all consider themselves Christians and all consider themselves the true Christians, you know? Mm-hmm. And Gospel of Philip, one of these texts, and I'll quote directly from here, it says of the empty rite of baptism of the Catholic Church, the initiate goes down into the water and comes up without having received anything. The anointing is superior to baptism. For from the anointing, we were called anointed ones, Christians, not because of the baptism. And Christ was also named because of the anointing. For the Father anointed the Son, and the Son anointed the apostles, and the apostle anointed us. Therefore, he who has been anointed has the all. He has the resurrection and the life, the Holy Spirit. If one receives this unction, this person is no longer a Christian, but a Christ. And in another Gnostic text, the Gospel of Truth, that Jesus came specifically so that he would, quote, might anoint them with the ointment. The ointment is the mercy of the Father. Those whom he anointed are the ones who have become perfect. And even in the Apocrypha, the apocryphal Acts of Thomas,
right,
to an ointment's entheogenic effects as being specifically derived from a certain plant. And I quote here directly, holy oil given us for sanctification, hidden mystery in which the cross was shown us. You are the unfolder of the hidden parts. You are the humiliator of stubborn deeds. You are the one who shows the hidden treasure. You are the plant of kindness.
Wow.
Come by this unction. So it's pretty clear that they placed a lot of importance on this. There's loads of references like this. In other Gnostic texts, Jesus is described as giving his followers a box of ointments and unguents and saying that you got to heal the body before you can heal the soul. So it's clear that such topical and medicinal herbal preparations were a part of early Christianity prior to the takeover by the Roman Catholic Church.
This is just amazing. It really is. And some churches, the one that I'm familiar with, uses oil that's, they say, some prayer over it. It's olive oil, and that's it. And it's used for the healing of the sick. But when you actually look at what you've written, there's so much more here than meets the eye in what the modern churches are now using oil for. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the oil that you're talking about. And even in Solomon's Song of Songs, which you also mentioned.
Yeah. There's cannabis in there, in amongst the Hebrew term, in amongst the incense trees and ointments, you know, and the how great its perfume is, you know. It's definitely been a long time part of the Middle Eastern religion. And we know this as well, as I mentioned, from Assyrian references, where we find similar use to topical ointments, according to Assyrian references, to open one's ear to God. And he's a major, there's lists of items that were due to the temple, you know, that were part of its stock and barrel. And cannabis is clearly listed in there. In one transaction, the questions are asked, what is the item, main items for the sacred rites? And the main items are water, honey, odorous plants, and cannabis. So it was specific to that sort of use, you know. And as I mentioned earlier, the Persian religion as well, you know. It's interesting, we find like a surviving use of cannabis amongst the Gnostic sects, the Manicheans, in the 12th century in China. Manicheans escaping the persecution of the Roman Catholic Church and its bringing into the Dark Ages and suppression of all competing sects, pagan and Gnostic alike. I guess Manicheans escaped into China, where eventually they fell out of favor there with the indigenous Han Chinese. But Chinese documents refer to these Manichean incense houses. And how they were uptight about the people staying up all night at these incense houses, and in mockery of the Manichean priests and priestesses, because you know, it should be remembered that male and females held equally powerful roles in the Gnostic religion. Mary Magdalene herself was considered the foremost knowledgeable apostle. They had an alternating priesthood in many occasions, where everybody in the congregation was expected to get up to the front at some point and present, you know. So very different structure than the hierarchy of what became the Roman Catholic Church, who basically felt they had some sort of copyright on God, and God was only accessible through a succession of priests, bishops, and popes and whatnot. But anyways, getting back to China and the Manicheans, in mockery of the Manicheans, the Chinese would actually use a pun. And in Chinese, the terms for spirit and cannabis are very similar. For cannabis, it's ma. For spirit, is mo. And the Manicheans would refer to their leaders themselves as spirit father and spirit mother. The Chinese, in mockery of them and in acknowledgement of their use of cannabis for these spiritual purposes, substituted mo, which meant ma, which meant hemp father instead of spirit father, and hemp mother, noting that their inspiration came through these means. So even in later accounts, we can be sure that cannabis was still playing a pivotal role in some Gnostic sects.
Well, it just makes sense that the plants that are on the earth should be and were a benefit to mankind.
They got demonized, and this is
they did.
The inception of the Dark Ages, which Christianity played a pivotal role in, you know. And everywhere that it says sorcery in the New Testament, it's the English translation of this Greek term pharmakia.
Oh, right. I was just going to bring up that term.
Yeah, same root we get the term pharmacy from, but it means the magical use of herbs in this context. And this was the great sorcery, you know, and the Gnostics who use these plants to experience divine revelations, they were accused of sorcery by the later church fathers and founders of the Catholic Church and the final compilers of what became the Bible, you know, and which was, as you mentioned, which was an edited version down of various documents. And the Nag Hammadi Library is a document that was hidden in the mountains to preserve it from the flames of these editorial fathers who wished to destroy all alternative history to the foundational period of Christianity.
Wow. Yes, I just never looked at all this until recently. It just blows my mind. Because I think we all grow up with certain beliefs and expectations, and so if we think that we know something, we're not going to look beyond what we know, because after all, we have the truth. Why would we seek any truth elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true for all of us. We all have that moment.
Sure.
Awakening that things are not as they seem.
Right. And it's interesting to me too that in many countries, whether you're talking about the Green Gang in in China, or whether you're talking about the people that run illicit drugs in this country, what we refer to as illicit drugs, are the people that are closest to the government. In other words, the government itself is making, has connections with Big Pharma in addition to running the so-called street drugs. Not all of them, but how do certain drugs get into certain communities?
Oh, I think, you know, it's clear that a lot of heroin and cocaine and stuff through military channels, you know.
Right.
Whether that be members of the military that have just kind of got in there and found a way to make some money, or whether something bigger, as in with the Iran-Contra affair and things like that, you know.
Right.
So, you know, it depends. Yeah, different things have happened in different time periods and with different people. How deep the orchestration of all that goes, I'm probably not the person to ask.
Right. I know you're into history. This is, and you, like I said at the beginning of the program, you are a true scholar. To dig all of this information out, and history is the foundation of what of our beliefs, and as you have indicated, we need to relook at what we thought we knew and reevaluate it, because things aren't as we've been told. Oh gosh.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's we're lucky to be in this wonderful age of information.
Oh,
where so many texts have been republished, and you have access to various translations of some of the oldest religious texts in existence, and then there's any sort of new archaeological discoveries that have taken place are able to get around the world in a day or two. It's spread around the world, information about it, and so we're really lucky to live in this wonderful age of information, and the ability to write a book like Libra 420, I don't think that ability was around like 20, 30 years ago.
Oh, no.
So I happen to be just, beneficial of living at this wonderful time when, services like Google Books has scanned page by page.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Documents, and you can search through them, hundreds, millions of books in a single search, and see what everything that's written on it just about.
Right. Wow. Oh my goodness. Let's jump ahead. Talk about the Green Grail.
Yeah, well, I have I talk about the Knights Templar and the myths of the Holy Grail.
Oh, yes. Okay.
It's interesting, the idea that there's some sort of Persian connection to the whole Holy Grail myth has long been known. Parsifal, the name itself, is thought to, one of the figures in the Holy Grail mythology, is thought to have been of Persian origin. And it's been compared to the cup of Jamashid, which is one of the sacred cups they drank the cannabis-infused wines out of in these Zoroastrian accounts I referred to earlier. And all that grew out of the earlier Paoma and Soma rituals. And the name of the ritual cup, which Soma was drank out of, was referred to as the Graha, which has similar phonetic similarities to the Grail, And the Knights Templar have long been associated with the Grail mythology, going back to Wolfram von Eschbach's earliest accounts in the 13th century of the Grail mythology. He refers to the Templars, So they've had this long association with it. And numbers of our authors, such as Dr. Camelia de Sico, have claimed that the Templars had this cannabis and aloe-infused palm wine known as the Elixir of Jerusalem. And I was trying to track down various references to this, and it appears a lot in books about aloe vera, strangely enough, I guess, because of the inclusion of aloe vera.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I could find as a reference. None of them listed in a source, you know, from the 13th century contemporary with the Templars. So it just seems to be hearsay. The earliest source I could find for it was the 90s. But when I went back to source documents about the Templars from their own time period, I was able to see that they had a contract with the Saracens, Arabs, to grow cannabis along with rare herbs like saffron for them in Spain. Now, the Saracens were not hemp fiber growers. They were growers of resin-quality cannabis and then growing it with a highly prized spice like saffron as indication that they were growing a more refined product than fiber. And besides that, at least on two of the raids of Templar sites and their famous arrests there on Friday the 13th and one of the later arrests in England, cannabis is listed on a seized, I have a considerable amount of it, too, pounds and pounds of it, listed on a list of seized inventory. And so it doesn't say what the form of cannabis was, but as other items are specifically listed, if it was rope or cloth or some sort of industrial product, I think it would have been listed as such. It's just listed as cannabis, which is kind of peculiar. Mm-hmm. And before the Templars had fallen out of favor with the church, a pope that was supportive of the Templars and their efforts and friends with the Templars, who after his own death was later accused of heresy, had put out a medical treatise that included a cannabis-infused wine, and also contemporary with the Templars in the Holy Land is the document known as the Portfolio of Villard de Honnecourt, a Mason. It's a Masonic document, Masonic lodge book. And it mostly consists of illustrations of various techniques of Islamic architecture and statuary. But it has one full page of text in the document, and that one full page of text is, in fact, a recipe that includes cannabis and other herbs and infused into a wine. And this leads into the role of cannabis into Europe, I would say, in both alchemy and magic. You know, at the same time, contemporary with the Templars, the Picatrix, a famous magical document, had been translated into Latin and was making its way through Europe, paving the way for what later became the ceremonial magic Western tradition. And it has a variety of drugs, opium, mandrake, and specifically prescribes cannabis resin as a means of invoking the deity of the moon mixed with stag blood and other items in a fumigation ritual. Again, a very smoky ritual. Apparently some sort of inhalation device was used to correctly intake the smoke. But after a certain time under its influences, a deity or a figure would appear in the smoke to the partaker of the substance.
Wow.
Discovered him at the same time period as the Knights Templar. And some have suggested that the Templars who were bringing numbers of Islamic documents over into Europe were familiar with this document and actually using it as well.
I want to backtrack just a moment. when Jesus was in the desert for 40 yep. days, 40 nights, to commune with his Father, do you suppose that he used cannabis or some sort of psychedelic kind of a substance?
Oh, I think it's very likely. You know, this is all in around his baptism by John. And when Jesus himself was referring to it, he says, you know, the Lord, thou hast anointed me. So it's, you know, maybe there's some anointing ritual taking place at the same time. And often in the Gnostic texts, anointing and baptisms were combined. Maybe a way of cleaning the body prior to the application of the oil or cleansing its effects or something like that, right? In other Gnostic documents, such as the Book of Jude, more specific ritual use is described, where complicated rituals, where an incense is burned, and it says the incense came with the agents.
Wow. Okay, well, we'll pick this up on the other side. Be right back. We'll be right back. is Deanna. Our guest is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. Now, the other question that I have is the anointing of Peter, James, and John up on the Mount. I'm thinking maybe that I now have a different perception of that incident, if it in fact happened.
Well, what's the specific passage that you're referring to?
I don't have a specific passage, but I just know that Jesus took them up on the mount, and they were the first presidency of the church, well, according to the 501c3 that I used to belong to, and that they were especially anointed.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm wondering.
Well, you know, it's pretty specific even in the Bible that there was some sort of power that came through the anointing oil, you know, and I can specifically point to 1 John 2:27 in this respect, where it says, "You have an anointing from the Holy One, and all of you know the truth. The anointing of you received from him remains in you, and you do not need anyone to teach you. But as his anointing teaches you about all things, and as that anointing is real, not counterfeit, just as it has taught you, remain in him." So that's pretty specific that, you know, some sort of something came through the oil, you know. And then even in Luke 4:16, Jesus repeats a passage from, you know, Isaiah, where he says, "The Spirit of God is upon me, because Yahweh has anointed me to bring good tidings to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to the and the opening of prisons and those who are bound," you know. And those words, they speak to me today, you know, when I think about the victims of this drug war and the people that have, you know, tried to treat their children for a debilitating disease like epilepsy. When this wonderful plant, you know, this like virtual tree of life has the ability to heal that, and parents are jailed for that. You know, it's just sickening when you think about it.
It is. Definitely is. And I think about the individuals who are on psych drugs like Prozac and some of these other mind-altering drugs, which are so detrimental to people. When there are really good things that they could be using that are natural and healing and not dangerous.
You know, absolutely. You know, and I live in Vancouver. There must be like 150 cannabis dispensaries in our city. And what my experience, you know, these have not become horrible drug dens. I see people from all walks of life. Young and old, you know, 19 and over, of course. they have some sort of, you know, specific medical, thing for something severe, you know. In all sorts of cultures, you know, and coming through and just getting better and looking better the more you see them in there. And these places are almost like community centers, you know. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, I think, you know, the roots of prohibition, ironically enough, we've been talking about all these biblical references, have largely come through fundamental religions, you know?
And all right.
That is, you know, that is Christian spear and the devil's weed, you know, and that it was largely demonized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because of this demonization, it's going to be hard for a lot of Christians to see through the propaganda and the, you know, I would say centuries of propaganda, you know, leading up to this type of thing, you know, beginning with the Dark Ages and the persecution of the cults that used them, continuing on with the burning of witches for using various herbs and things like that, into the New World, where indigenous cultures were persecuted for the use of peyote and ayahuasca in Africa, iboga, and other substances deemed as witchcraft and sorcery by Christian forces that were colonizing these areas. And I think that, you know, when it's fully understood the role of cannabis and other entheogenic substances, in the ancient world, and particularly here in the West in regards to this biblical stuff, that it's a much of a threat to fundamental religion. As Darwin's theory of evolution was to the myths of Genesis, in that what it reveals is the plant-based shamanic origins of these religions themselves, something that as these religions spread the world, they've done everything they could to squash whenever they perceived it.
Right. It makes me very suspicious, of course, of the reason why the U.S. military and its allies have destroyed much of Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, just destroyed them.
Yeah.
Destroyed their culture, destroyed their infrastructure. What are they trying to hide besides just taking over what most people say, oh, they're just there for the oil? Well, which oil are they talking about? The history or what? Okay,
we'll be right back. We're talking about academic suppressions going on.
Yes. Okay, we'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. My guest today is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. And right before we went to the break, you were saying something that needs to be said.
Yeah, I was talking about academic suppression of research, and this is something that numbers of scholars that I know of have run up against. I know Dr. David Hillman, who has a background in both chemistry and the classics of ancient Greece and Rome, when he tried to write his PhD thesis on the role of psychoactive substances in ancient Greece and Rome, it was rejected by the panel doing the thesis. He ended up publishing it as a book later. I know Carl Ruck as well at one point was receiving a lot of opposition, Professor Carl Ruck at Boston University, a lot of opposition to his interest in areas of research in contacting Greek authorities about possible residue studies from an archaeological site. At first enthusiastic, but once they realized it was could potentially lead to evidence of drug use, they were quite opposed to any sort of samples being taken. A similar case with Professor Scott Littleton, I know, as well, who ran into this type of thing. And a lot of this is just like inherent Western prejudice against these substances and also ignorance. You know, many of the academics involved probably have little to no experience with these substances and don't really realize the sort of psychological states that they can produce and just have some sort of drug war era understanding of that. You can really see that in the history of the history, in the sense that in the 19th century, authors and historians much more freely mentioned and suggested the role of psychoactive substances in the Asian world than they did post-drug war in the modern world. It's only now in the last few decades where people are really feeling comfortable to even start discussing it and talking about it. Interestingly, Science, the academic journal magazine, on its volume 360 on April 20th, had an article about recent residue samples of cannabis and opium that were taken for various artifacts in Mesopotamia, Anatolia, Egypt, and the Levant. So, you know, it's starting to change. And, you know, now that we can acknowledge the use of substances in these regions, perhaps the idea that they will be playing a role in ritual use is becoming, you know, more understandable.
I think also that we need to remember where the funding comes from some of the universities when people are attempting to write a thesis, that the funding may influence their choices of what people can write. As you said, it's academic freedom or lack thereof.
Yeah, and also what's going to get you the sufficient marks to get the grades you need to receive a PhD in the case of Dr. Hillman, you know?
Right.
So Yeah, it's a tough call. You know what I mean? You get somebody that's dead against these. The implications are, as I said, very, very profound. You know, like there's evidence, you know, we can take a look at the world's religions today. You know, Christianity, Judaism, we've discussed, Zoroastrianism, we've discussed, Hinduism, Shiva, one of the main gods of the Hindu pantheon, one of the oldest continually worshipped gods on earth, is well known for his love of cannabis as the Indian drink bomb. And his devotees to this day, sadhus and yogis, and we can find in the various Indian festivals and along the banks of the Ganges River, regularly partake of cannabis before sitting down to do their yoga kasanas and other things, you know. In the Sikh religion, we have the example still existent of the Nihang Sikhs, the warrior Sikhs, who used to guard the Sikh holy sites, and their use of a cannabis beverage as sukkadun. In Taoism, in China, we know that it was specifically used, it was referred to as a plant of immortality, and was a means of gaining access to the land of the immortals, in ancient Taoist writings from 2,500 years ago, you know. In the Shinto religion of Japan, the hemp cloth and hemp fiber paper is still ritually celebrated. In the Buddhist religion, there's, you know, myths from over 2,000 years ago about how the Buddha subsisted on one hemp seed a day while he sat in meditation under the Bodhi tree. You know, and these are the major religions of the world, you know, and here's this evidence of cannabis use in all these different traditions, and somehow it's come to be prohibited and demonized. But at that same time, that demonization and prohibition, it's kind of like when you kink a hose, something builds in pressure to that oppression. And cannabis itself has become a symbol of freedom the world over. And there's been this organic movement growing up around this plant, you know. We need to hang on to it, as you mentioned, the corporate attempts to take over it and stuff like that. But I think that, you know, the spirituality around this plant that's prevalent around the globe is evidence of a perennial religion, a natural religion. This is not some book written by man. This is a herb created by the Creator.
Right. And it's very interesting that when people are using these things throughout all of these religions that you mentioned, when we look at modern society, particularly here in this country, we see people so busy. Both parents work and their children are off playing soccer and this and that, that nobody has time to just sit and relax and meditate and think and to get in touch with themselves and with God.
Threat, I think. You know, it's a threat to the industrial military complex.
Yes.
Well, Bill Hicks, he did a skit about once, you know, about cannabis. And it was along the lines of, you know, do I feel like going in to work at the plant on the assembly line today after smoking a joint? Or do I feel like maybe staying home and practicing my bass guitar? And cannabis will lead you to realize that time and free time is one of the most precious things there is. You know what I mean? It might kill your desire a little bit for that BMW when you have to weigh out how much of your time you're going to have to spend at the office in order to get that BMW. And you weigh that against time you might spend at the beach surfing and smoking some herb with your brothers and sisters, you know?
Yes. Now, what about the idea that some corporation will genetically modify cannabis?
Well, I think that's always a danger with everything that we're consuming and that becomes industrialized as a means of economy, you know.
Right.
And that's an ever-present danger that we have to be vigilant to stand against and to expose when it does happen, so that people can get craft quality herb that is grown by people that care about this plant and their intent is pure when they're producing it. You know what I mean? It has to be that type of open market, so that maybe you go to your friend that lives down the street that grows some really fine herb and treats it organically or something like that, as opposed to getting the Zandaz version of the herb, which has been standardized and sprayed with chemicals. And
like Roundup or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Terrible, terrible.
Well, you know, I think that is getting out and that it's become so popular is great because, I think that this, information that we're talking about today would have been much more jeopardy if cannabis was restrained. But now that it's out everywhere, people can get this message and still have access to it. And any attempt to put that genie back in the bottle or
it's too late.
Yes, too late. It's out.
Yes. Too late.
All the nations of the world can rant and rave, but it's not going to happen.
On page 158, you say, the aloes and spices brought by Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea to Jesus' tomb to supposedly embalm their now dead leader pose a particularly curious question. As embalming was not a practice of the Jews of the time.
Well, this is a very controversial area of the book, and this is something that I've discussed in my other books as well. And this goes back to the Templars, too, because they were accused of heresy, and one of the heresies that they were accused of was mocking the cross. And how could these good Christian soldiers become to mock the most pivotal form of Christian symbolism? You know, the whole of Christianity, particularly the Catholic Church, is based on the death and resurrection of the Lord, you know? Mm-hmm. And an American professor, Dr. Hugh Schofield, he wrote a book, The Passover Plot. And
yes, I read that.
Yeah. He suggested that Jesus on the cross was given some sort of soporific potion that threw him into a death-looking, seeming-like coma, and that he didn't actually die on the cross, but he was just in this suspended state. Mm-hmm. That appeared dead to primitive people of the time. And interestingly, in the 19th century, a group of biblical scholars and doctors concurred that the mirrored wine given to Christ on the cross was a preparation of Indian hemp infused into wine, you know, and in Talmudic times, they talk about putting incense into the wine of those on their way for crucifixion to ease the pain. Now, interestingly, cannabis-infused wine is the oldest form of anesthetic that we know of, written in the Chinese, where they perform complicated operations, where by giving people cannabis-infused wine and knocking them out, and threw them into a suspended state where they can perform complicated operations.
And amazing.
So, the idea is that Jesus was perhaps given some sort of preparation, maybe not just purely cannabis. Other potent herbs like mandrake and other substances could be used to induce these same sort of states, and then appeared dead on the cross, and then his secret servant Nicodemus, who is described as a secret servant, shows up with aloes and barrows to revive him. And that the whole thing was a hoax. And, you know, we can take a look at the earlier resurrection in the Bible, Lazarus. You know, it's clearly
right
to help build people's faith in Jesus. People are saying he's going to die if we don't get there. And Jesus is like, hold up. There's something's going to happen so that you may believe. And then he goes and he calls him out. Professor Morton Smith said that what was described was a standard sort of death and resurrection initiation ceremonies that were popular in the Mideast. Those, like I talked about with the early Zoroastrian figures, where they would drink these cannabis-infused wines, be knocked out into a comatose state, known as starred, a death-like state, and were thought to have left their body and traveled, where the body lay in a suspended animation. And interestingly, a doctor in the 19th century, Dr. James Braid of Edinburgh, he wrote a book, Trance and Human Hibernation. He suggested that fakirs and other figures, holy men in India and in Islamic countries, that were performing miracles such as feigning death, being buried in the ground for a few days, being dug up later by their assistants and awakened with preparations of cannabis extracts and yoga techniques. And they described these same instances. The figures would dig up their former guy. He would appear there like he's completely dead, completely stiff, and head rolled over on his shoulder, no sign of life. And they'd start rubbing him slowly and start stretching out his arms. And then after an hour or so, he'd start showing signs of life and then come back into full states of awareness. So now we're presented with the challenge to the source of the Christian religion, source of the Bible, source of Catholicism. Did Jesus die on the cross and are people really cleansed of their own sins and crimes by that death and his alleged resurrection? And this is the source of power that the church holds over the people. Or was there some sort of background conspiracy going on at the time in order to gain the people's faith in the new Messiah? That in the techniques that were known at the time of mimicking death, you know. And it's interesting because the Templars, they had likely been introduced to cannabis by a group known as the Hashishins. And the Hashishins grew out of the Persian region where the Zoroastrian cults were. And they had an initiation ceremony where the individual was given some sort of hashish infusion, likely some sort of hashish and wine infusion, appeared dead to those present and thought that they had died and gone to the Islamic paradise, where they were allegedly taken into a secret garden and introduced to maidens and streams flowing with wine and honey, and then brought back, you know, knocked out again with the same preparation and brought back and told, you have seen paradise. Whether that's true or not, that's probably a Western interpretation of some sort of initiation ceremony. But interestingly, the earliest European accounts of cannabis there, you know, post-Templar are Marco Polo, where that tale I just described takes place, and the Decameron, which has an account of a priest tricking a non-believer with a potent cannabis infusion, making him appear dead to both outsiders, putting him into a tomb where he thought he died and was in a tomb, you know, all with cannabis. So the idea that that these types of preparations can induce that state were definitely traveling in there at that same time.
Makes one wonder what kind of wine that Jesus created for the guests at the wedding.
Yeah, at the Miracle of Cana, which has the very similar name to the root of cannabis.
Yes.
Well, it was good wine. They wanted more. It was a good part. Jesus
Amazing.
Kept the party going, you know. I was mentioning earlier the Book of Jude, and in that book, one of the Gnostic texts, Jesus is described as putting vine branches into wine. And may well have been some sort of cannabis-infused wine in that account. There's a variety of plants used in that ritual with male and female disciples. And he puts plants in their mouths, puts plants into wine vessels. They burn an incense that has the agency of Zoroastra, as I mentioned earlier, you know. And there's other accounts of the Gnostic leader Marcus, who he has put something he calls grace, charas into wine, which is very similar to an Indian name for cannabis resins, but it supposedly is meant to mean grace, and he throws that into wine, and this wine is used in a complicated kind of tantric ritual-like context with a woman, but definitely some sort of psychoactive wine, and authors have been suggesting this is the case for some time.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Amazing. Just amazing information. It just kind of blows my mind because, as I said, we don't know what we don't know. And when one is presented with new information that that totally contradicts what they've been taught, it's very difficult. But it makes sense.
Well, you know, again, this is why I've listed in my books such references and sources, you know, and sometimes I'm hesitant to do interviews because it represents the full effect.
All righty. Hang on just a minute. We'll be right back. All right. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. And you're talking about interviews and your bibliography and the fact that you do list all of these sources, which I really do appreciate. And certainly you could not talk about 18 minutes.
Like, you know what I mean? It's like, you're making claims like, oh, Jesus used cannabis. You know, it's like people are probably thinking, where's this guy getting this from? I never learned this in Sunday school. It's important to understand that there's a lot of research about this, and that's why it's gotten a lot of media attention and it's been covered in respected journals like the BBC and The Guardian and Washington Post have had articles about it because it's not so easily dismissed.
Oh, absolutely. In chapter 11, you talk about tinctures, which I make a lot of tinctures, and because I really believe in doing that, I think they're more potent, more applicable, healthier than the things that Big Pharma makes. So would you like to talk about tinctures?
This particularly appears in alchemy, in a branch of alchemy known as phagiric alchemy, which is deeply evolved around the role of plants, and particularly in tincture preparations that are known by the names of quintessences and arcanums. Quintessences and arcanums could be anywhere from a wine infusion to a more refined, almost pure alcohol type of infusion, right? And the famous alchemist Paracelsus, who's also one of the fathers of modern medicine, he said the potency of a plant, you know, you could get like a 20 pounds potency of a plant down to just a few ounces in one of these tinctures by the concentration levels, you know, so you could increase the medical efficaciousness of this preparation. He's probably best known for his creation of laudanum, which was a tincture of opium. But he also had an arcanum that contained cannabis and other herbs that was specifically used for epilepsy. And we know that these types of preparations were used by other alchemists because in the Lullian Corpus, which is the works of an alchemist known as Lully, or works that are attributed to him at least, cannabis appears in, you know, references to the quintessences and the different variations of plants that could be used in them. And other alchemists as well, like Cardano, write about potent cannabis infusions and tinctures. So there's a variety of these types of references to these. It's not just cannabis. Other plants were used in quintessences and arcanums and prepared in the same way and applied for different medical and spiritual applications. Usually arcanums were generally more about the spiritual end and quintessences were more about the medical end of thing. But there are crossovers in both those terms. So that's not a clear-cut delineation. But these were important substances used in alchemy, and some saw them as a step in the preparation in the making of what is known as the philosopher's stone.
All righty. Okay, we're at the top of the hour. We will take phone calls in the next hour at 800-313-9443. Be right back.
Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420. Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult, as well as several other books. And he has participated or added or contributed chapters on the historical role of cannabis in several other works. He's a real scholar. Just very impressed. It's just wonderful. And in your book, you talk about Freemasons, guilds, secret societies. Can you speak to us about those?
Yeah, well, this again comes back to certain aspects of Masonic history, mostly related to what's known as the Scottish Rite, which the Scottish Rites themselves claim to have been derived from the Templars. Now, whether that's historically accurate or not is definitely a matter of debate. Many scholars believe that this was something that was created in the 18th century. But the stories of their origins themselves all attribute them to the Templars. And in some of the Scottish rites, there's a drink variously referred to as the bitter cup, which is compared to Jesus's drink on the cross. You know, so that's why they're called the bitter cup. It's the same drink that Jesus took on the cross that we've been talking about in relation to the crucifixion and resurrection. And they are basically death and rebirth ceremonies. And I have suggested that in their origins, there may be some indications that this is actually related to the Templars' use of cannabis, and that they grew out of this knowledge about the bitter cup and the crucifixion and resurrection, which we were discussing being a potential potent drug potion, which threw Jesus into a suspended animation state, mimic death, and the whole crucifixion being a hoax, in a sense. And so this is what I'm suggesting, is that there was some, maybe some perhaps element of this that survived. And we know of figures in the 18th century, such as Johann Schropper, who were serving punches at complicated rituals and Masonic rites, now known under the name Phantasmagoria, where special effects were used, such as reflections in mirrors with lanterns reflected into pillars of smoke to make it appear as figures were in the smoke and taking form, you know, but combined with the use of a psychoactive punch. And cannabis has been suggested as the likely culprit in this case, because Schropper was a coffee house owner, and the coffee was often traveling with hashish and vice versa at this time period. And similarly, Cagliostro has been suggested as going back to 18th century references, has been suggested as having used famous alchemist and Freemason, has been suggested of using cannabis and other drugs at his Masonic rituals. Recently, an individual, P.D. Newman, has written a book suggesting that Cagliostro was using some preparation of the potent chemical DMT, the active ingredient in the ayahuasca brews of the jungle. People were seeing visions and things like that at the Masonic rites of Cagliostro. And we know later figures like Aleister Crowley were using in their initial rituals for organizations such as the Order Templar Orientis, which they themselves claim connecting to the Knights Templars, that drugs were used in the bitter cup of their versions of these earlier Masonic rites. So definitely some of the quasi-Masonic groups and fringe Masonic organizations were using such psychoactive substances in this sort of context. And there's, you know, even in the 17th century, they in Masonic documents that have been unearthed in papers recently, they refer to an elixir and stuff like that, and how having a knowledge of this elixir was needed to go back up to the seventh level.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the whole occult thing, you know, like Rosicrucians as well, Pascal Beverly Randolph, who was the first American Rosicrucian Grand Master, who lived from 1825 to 1875. He was also the biggest commercial importer of hashish into North America in his lifetime. And he was prescribing cannabis in various formulations. There's indications he may have even had some idea about the differing effects of what we came to know as THC and CBD, offering different extractions with different effects of cannabis in various tinctures and stuff like that in the United States by mail order, and traveling around the country with his wife Mary Jane selling them as well. And he wrote extensively about the role of cannabis as medicinal qualities as well as its spiritual qualities, and deeply involved with the Rosicrucian movement, and likewise over in Europe and France with figures like Di Giotto and other figures associated with Rosicrucian. And they were deeply involved with the use of cannabis for magical purposes, mirror scrying, and also astral traveling, which is basically stepping through the looking glass of the magic mirror into the astral realm, you know. And it's interesting, you know, like I've thought a lot about how cannabis came to be used in conjunction with magic mirrors or seeing visions in smoky fumigations or in entering the astral plane. And I've concluded in Liber 420 that this may have some relationship with cannabis's complicated relationship with dreaming. Now, one of the effects that daily users of cannabis report is they dream a lot less. And I've noticed that myself, but then I've noticed that, you know, a couple of times I've woken up at 4 in the morning or something like that, maybe it was 4:20, and consumed a little cannabis, and then I've gone back to sleep, and I've had the most intense lucid dreams that I've ever had. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. It's generally you think of cannabis as something that suppresses dreams. But interestingly, in the 1980s, they were studying cannabis's effects on melatonin, which is very influential on dreaming, melatonin levels. And they found that immediately following consumption of cannabis, smoked cannabis in this case, about 20 minutes later, they took a baseline of the person's melatonin, and then again 20 minutes later, and they said they noticed as much as a 4,000 times increase of daily melatonin levels. So there's this huge spike of melatonin taking place with cannabis use. And so spiking it all day through using cannabis likely depletes its release at night and causes a suppression of dreaming, whereas in my case of using it at 4 in the morning and taking it, I get this, I've already been into kind of a deeper sleep state. I go back into sleep, and I get this huge spike of melatonin, and it causes these very vivid, realistic dreams. And the mirror may have acted as sort of a template for the split between the unconscious or subconscious mind and the regular state of awareness. And when I'm talking about the Freud termed the subconscious and what his student Jung termed the unconscious, we're talking about an area of the mind that is hidden beneath the regular states of awareness, and is not in our present awareness. When we think about dreaming, this is one of the most obvious areas where we can see this. We're in a dream, yet at the same time, we are the one telling ourselves that dream. We're the other people in that dream. And so it's this clear division of consciousness. Our aware consciousness is the subject to our unconscious, subconscious, when we dream at night. And it is this aspect of consciousness which early researchers into the effects of cannabis, such as Dr. J.J. Moreau in the 19th century, and their comparison to the cannabis-intoxicated state with the dream state and also states of madness that people were experiencing in asylum, of what we know as the unconscious, subconscious mind. Now, Freud, as opposed to Jung, he saw the subconscious as being like things like repressed memories, daily information that we don't need to remember, just kind of pushed off into this basement of awareness that once in a while would rise up, maybe in present in issues we have with our mummy issues and projection onto women and issues around dirt and things like that relating to our potty training, things like that. Whereas his student Jung, he thought there was below this, an even deeper level of consciousness that was related to the experience of the human species, the memory of our ancestors. And he referred to this aspect of the collective unconscious. And he suggested that myths and symbols appealed to our conscious awareness because an aspect of our genetic memory remembered these things. And he compared this to the function known as instinct in other animals. A sea elephant is born for food the day it's born. Deer can stand up and walk around. We have this, but it's buried beneath our frontal lobes and our ability for higher thinking, and it's deeply buried in there through the subconscious and the unconscious. And it may be that cannabis and these other substances, psychoactive substances that affect the pineal gland, like DMT and mescaline, cannabis indirectly through a spike in melatonin, may be accessing deeper kind of genetic and collective memories and awareness of the species. And I think that is really profound, you know. And so in a sense, the one speaking to these mirror diviners and mirror scryers from the mirror was the same one that was telling them their dreams at night. But they willfully invoking that aspect of consciousness and attaining what in alchemical terms might be deemed the marriage of the sun and the moon, the marriage of our present aware daytime awareness with our moon, noetic, poetic form of awareness under the guise of the moon.
Now, I think that a lot of people have a calcified pineal gland.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've heard
it doesn't work.
Yeah, that, you know, that may be the case. I don't know enough about the science behind that to really comment on the alleged calcification from fluoride and other chemicals that were being forced upon us. I think, I don't know, you know, I'm feeling like my mind's okay. We don't use fluoride.
Oh, I think it probably is. talk to us about the Kabbalah. You mentioned the Kabbalah in...
Yeah, well, you know, at least one Kabbalistic scholar, Ari Kaplan, who was also, suggested kind of Boston as a potential reference to cannabis, has noted that, early Kabbalists were noted for burning, grasses in some of their rituals, which might be psychoactive herbs, and there's other indications of the use of psychoactive herbs. But I think you need a basic understanding of, what's known as the Kabbalistic tree of life to understand any of the Western magical traditions. And I include in this things like astrology and tarot as well as ceremonial magic. And, basically the Kabbalistic tree of life is said to be a map of the universe. And it's, if you Google it, you'll be able to find an image of it pretty quick. And it's different spheres on this tree-like structure, going up in three different, pillars. And, In the spheres, the pillars actually represent planetary bodies, the sun, the moon, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the main seven planets. And these different planets are said to be represented in the microcosm, the little universe, which is the man, and the macrocosm, the big universe. And because of this correlation, they affect these channels and aspects of ourselves in them, you know. And in a sense, you can kind of see, you know, in Mars might be our will to war, and Jupiter our will to power, and Mercury our will to communicate, and Venus our will to love, you know. And these different aspects of consciousness in these spheres, and these spheres and all the pathways between these spheres, the 22 pathways that connect them, are thought to map out the universe. And a lot of every plant, animal, color, incense type, you know, mineral was attributed to one of these spheres or the pathways between these spheres in association. So if you were doing a ritual that was, you know, to be, say, focused around battle, you might do something that was dedicated to the planet Mars with all different associations with Mars, the specific color Kabbalistically associated with it, and this type of thing. And this is the basis of a lot of the type of magic you see in the Picatrix and Sefer Raziel and other types of things, and why certain plants are used in certain rituals and that sort of thing. So it's very specific in that way, but it's also a map of our consciousness. It's like a map of consciousness components, that our anger and our love are in different aspects of our consciousness that come together, you know, with the other aspects of the will to power and hunger and love and all these types of things to form this cohesive state of consciousness which we experience the world through. And that through an understanding of the Kabbalah, we could undo these various spheres of consciousness. And it's kind of related to to Gnosticism in this way as well, where the seven planetary spheres were seen as archon that clothed light in matter as it descended into matter and had to be taken back off again as we travel back through the planetary spheres to the kingdom of light at death. And so it's by understanding these different spheres of consciousness and how that we make up consciousness, we can undo them as well and get down to that core of consciousness, you know, in the Kabbalistic view, which is the Godhead of consciousness, you know, which may well be intertwined with these deeper aspects of the collective unconscious that I was referring to, and genetic memory, which theoretically contain genetically a memory of going back to the very origins of life. You know?
Wow. Now, you have a chapter on Shakespeare.
Yeah.
We do have a caller. And then let's talk about Shakespeare on pot. We have a caller. It's Fred in Michigan.
Hi, Deanna.
Hi.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Fred, how you doing? Hey,
this is great. Thanks. When I was a pre-med student, I had a German lady, Schindler, PhD for medical botany. And I was introduced, this would have been 1979, I was introduced all of this, cannabis, is it, you know, ancient cultures, medicinal mushrooms. Chris mentioned, you know, the herb of immortality. Well, there's a sort of like a counterpart. A reishi is known as the mushroom of immortality. And
yeah.
Chris, when you mentioned melatonin, oh man, here in Michigan, tart cherries is a big time cash crop, the biggest in Michigan. So about 25 years ago, I bought my first bottle of tart cherry concentrate, okay? And it was a company from up north, and on the bottle, it listed three major university studies. One, Michigan State University, they proved that tart cherry compounds are 10 times more effective as an anti-inflammatory analgesic than all other known NSAIDs, etc. University of Iowa proved that tart cherry compounds were 7 times more effective at inducing tumor regression than all known tested anti-tumor, anti-cancer agents. And I know that cannabis, medicinal cannabis, whatever, has the same attributes. The other study, University of Texas, guy by the name of Russell J. Reeder, MD. Speaking of melatonin, Dr. Reeder proved that with proper consumption, maybe a couple tablespoons of tart cherry concentrate a day, would ensure optimum levels of melatonin production by the pineal gland. When that would happen, people with hypertension, that would be normalized, and they also found that optimum levels of melatonin not only prevented cancer, but reversed it. How do you like that?
Wow, cool. Interesting.
That is cool. Okay, we're going to a break. We'll pick this up on the other side. Be right back. Our guest today is Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. Do we still have Fred on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here, Deanna. Hey, I want to bring up something about King Baldwin II of Jerusalem, 1118. The Templars were there, and that's when they apparently organized officially at King Solomon's Temple with King Baldwin II. That was 1118. And I suspect they might have been lighting up their doobies at that point. I also want to bring up that I met a young lady, in her late 20s, and this was a decade ago. She was born with a deformed spine. I forgot what it's called. Anyway, pain hell every day, Deanna. She was like, awesomely painful just to get up out of bed. And she started drinking, high quality cannabis liquid concentrate and abracadabra in like, I don't know what, I think she said 24 hours, she's pain free. That was decade ago. And Deanna and Chris, on Michigan State University's FM station, every Sunday they have a special broadcast. A year ago, a young lady, a military vet, who was diagnosed with some really bad cancer because she was exposed to DU a lot over there. And so they said, her name is Spalding, and they told her, look, Karen, if you don't do what we tell you, you're going to be dead in 6 months. You know what they wanted her to do, right? Radiation, sure. Chemo. She says, no, I have a better idea. Right? So she goes on to the liquid cannabis protocol, drinking it, totally pain-free, totally cancer-free. And at the time frame when she was supposed to have been dead, totally free of cancer, totally cured. And she said her doctors avoid her like she's a terrorist. They won't talk to her.
Ignorance is bliss, I suppose.
More and more miracle stories, like, for sure, yeah. You know, lots
of people. Chris, I got to ask you, Chris, because here in Michigan, that company that I told you about, the Tart Cherry, on their label, they had all these university studies that I identified. Okay, so about, I don't know, 6 months, 9 months later, when I went to restock, I buy like 9 bottles at a time. I go back, and the label is totally different. I called them up, and they said, yeah, well, the Fraud and Death Agency told us if we didn't remove the data, we'd be out of business.
Yeah, well, those studies aren't like certification from the Food and Drug Administration by any means, which costs, you know, millions of dollars to acquire through all the tests that they do, and prevents anybody that's not a big pharmaceutical interest for pursuing it. And they're attacking all sorts of natural products under that same sort of banner.
Yeah, Chris, you're right, and that's exactly what they told me. They said FDA said, well, if they would sponsor a multi-site study that would cost like $10 million, whatever, after the study's proved the data, then they could retain the data on their label. So they said, no, we'll just change the label, right? So yeah. I had to get that out there, Deanna. Thanks for that, because I think, Chris, that the combination could really be awesome for a lot of people, the tart cherry concentrate with the cannabis.
Mm. Yeah, well, interesting stuff for sure. And lots of people reporting lots of effectivity for different types of cancer with these cannabis oils that Rick Simpson and other people have been promoting for some time now.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much, Brad.
Thanks, Deanna.
All righty, bye-bye. Okay, was Shakespeare on pot?
Well, this is interesting. This is a story I've been following myself for close to 2 decades. And this goes to 2 South African academics, Professor Francis Thackeray and Professor Nicholas Vandermeer, a theory that Shakespeare was a secret cannabis user, and that references to the Dark Lady in his sonnets were actually veiled references to cannabis use. And based on their theory, they were able to convince the Avalon Trust in England, I guess is they have the property where Shakespeare lived, mm-hmm. and artifacts found on the property include various fragments from old pipes, smoking pipes, clay pipes. Were often broke and stuff like that. And they acquired a number of samples of these pipes from Shakespeare's property in the time period he lived in. And some of them did, in fact, according to tests, sort of tests that they would do identify drugs at a crime scene. The police actually did the test. And they showed residues of cannabis in some of the pipe fragments. which added to their theory. And interestingly, in Shakespeare's A Midsummer's Night's Dream, which is about the King of the Fairies, Oberon.
Right.
Mentioned earlier, there's this grimoire now known as the Book of Oberon because it has an invocation of Oberon, has a recipe for cannabis ointments used in conjunction with magic mirrors.
Wow. Alrighty, we're taking a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Chris Bennett, the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. And we're talking about Shakespeare on pot, and you just mentioned the work, A Midsummer Night's Dream, and when I took a class on Shakespeare, I remember that thinking, wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, also in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the figure of Puck is also referred to as Robin Goodfellow. And
yes.
It's a very important figure in English folklore who has a long history of connection with cannabis. His catchphrase, in fact, was hemp and hampen. And all sorts of folk stories about him helping maidens break the fibers off the hemp stalks and helping them with their chores and demanding that hemp be given to the people and stuff like that. Robin Goodfellow is also associated with the history of Robin Hood. And it's said that the 12 merry men and Robin Hood that make up the number of a witch's coven, 13, and Robin Goodfellow was often the name taken by heads of witches' covens, according to some accounts.
Indeed. So, according to the evidence, Shakespeare actually did use pot.
Well, there's, you know, pipes from his property, certainly.
Yes.
Were found that contained residues of cannabis, and certainly he must have had some awareness of his occult connections, because in A Midsummer Night's Dream, he has Puck, who's associated with Robin Goodfellow, say, "What hemp and homespuns do we have here near the cradle of the fairy queen?" Incorporated an ointment put in eyes on bequest of Oberon, who had a grimoire contemporary to this period where cannabis was used for seeing visions and magic mirrors.
Hmm. Wow. Now, there were the other works that he composed that also had indications of his pot use, correct?
Well, there's, you know, the evidence of awareness of drug use. We were talking about the sorts of potion that put somebody into a death-like state of suspended animation. And in Romeo and Juliet, there's the account where Juliet wants to fool people into thinking she's dead so she can escape and be with Romeo, and drinks
right.
A vial and appears dead. But then Romeo sees her and thinks she's actually died and commits suicide. And then she wakes up and sees he's dead and commits suicide. So that's the same sort of tincture we were talking about in relation to the Decameron and the Templars and the whole crucifixion thing. And it's also suggested that Prospero the magician in The Tempest, the story of The Tempest, is based on the Elizabethan magician Dr. John Dee, who was for seeing, using magic mirrors with his scribe, Edward Kelly. and they were doing this in the same time period that the Sefer Raziel, Liber Salomonis, and the Book of Oberon were being passed around as grimoires prescribing the use of cannabis with magic mirrors. And in John Dee's writings about these visionary events, which are still popular today with the cultists, he talks about drinking an elixir that makes him feel drowsy. And in another event, Edward Kelly, the scribe, is trying to talk to a deity in a mirror, and he's like, well, you haven't brought me any drugs. How come you don't have any drugs here? And Kelly shows the mirror an empty apothecary box, which is a drug box, and then the entity in the mirror saying, well, what about ointments? Don't you have any ointments? So it's pretty clear that psychoactive substances were being used in at least some of these occasions of mirror scrying as prescribed in contemporary grimoires of the time.
Right. Now, in Chapter 19, The Church versus the Devil's Weeds, and you refer to the 1484 papal bull and Pope Innocent the 13th, the 8th. And supposedly he condemned cannabis use as a form of satanic mass.
Yeah, that's not true. This is, I also tried to address some of the misinformation that spread around about cannabis history. And numbers of books on the history of cannabis have suggested that that was the case, that Pope Innocent released his papal bull, which condemned cannabis as a satanic sacrament. And I read it in so many different books, I just assumed it was correct. But when you go back to the actual document in Latin, as a friend of mine, Tom Hatzis, has done, and Dr. Ethan Russo has done as well, that's not the case at all. It doesn't mention cannabis. There's no mention of any sort of drug whatsoever in it. So I'm not sure where that misinformation originated, but it's been spread around for decades, and it's been some time. In fact, the relationship between the church and cannabis is complicated, and drugs in general, different things happened at different times and places, and we're talking about centuries of history here, so it's difficult to pin down anything particular like that. Like, you could have a situation where, as I mentioned earlier, a pope that was friendly with the Templars wrote a medical treatise and included a recipe for a cannabis.
All right.
And it was perfectly acceptable at the time. Later, that same pope was dug up after he had died and condemned of heresy. Different things happened at different times. And a lot of it depended on how you used it and the conjunction of it. And it was the conjunction of, maybe being in possession of some sort of evidence of magical use along with the herbs that was particularly damning in the eyes of the church, And we can see that they definitely had their eyes on cannabis, because in that same chapter, I have a Catholic document where cannabis is compared to the ways of the sinner, and they go always twisted like cannabis rope, and it must rot like cannabis ready in the field, and all these different ways that the sinners were like cannabis, and the cannabis plant is totally demonized. And so there must have been some association there that caused this comparison to take place. You might have a situation where cannabis medicine might be purely okay, but then if there's certain invocation and prayers in combination with that, where it would be seen as very heretical and a total sin.
Sure.
And, so there's different things happening at different times and places.
Right. All righty, we have a caller, Jeff in Georgia. Jeff, welcome.
Hello, how y'all doing?
Great.
I had
you?
A question. Good. I didn't listen to the whole program. I've listened to pieces of it. But, I remember we went to the moon. I remember it well. I remember the 70s when more people started smoking pot. I seen a lot of them ruin their lives. Today, I see marijuana being pushed for medicinal purposes. But, could we have went to the moon? I mean, should the president be smoking dope? How about the Pope? I mean, I think...
Well, you know, a famous rocket scientist that helped pave the way for getting to the moon. You bring up our ability to go to the moon was this figure known as Jack Parsons, one of the founders of Caltech. Rocket scientist, well-known rocket scientist, and a user of cannabis. So, expert in rocket fuel... An expert in rocket fuel, solid rocket fuels that paved the way for rockets. And he was a user of cannabis. So if you're going to talk about something like getting to the moon, then yeah, cannabis does play a role in that because one of the greatest rocket scientists of history, Jack Parsons, was a user of cannabis. And if you're going to judge people for, you know, you talk about lives ruined in the 60s. I don't see that. You know, I think you take a look at any sample of music that's worthwhile, that's persevered, people are still listening to 50 years after it was written. You take a look at rock and roll and how much of that was influenced by the use of cannabis. And things like fighting the Vietnam War, questioning the government, women's liberation. You know, one of the biggest things they pointed to in the fight against the Vietnam War was the cannabis smoke in the fields. This is why Nixon, you know, who was a racist, who helped initiate the war on drugs and blamed its use on Jews and blacks and people like that. So, you know, you want to talk about social change. I don't know. I see the 60s as a great time of social change and cannabis playing a pivotal role in that social change myself.
Okay, we could talk about the 60s all day. You remember the coup d'etat of Kennedy. Now, you know, that had Jewish interest, okay?
Well,
there was a lot
Kennedy
of things.
Himself. Some people say Kennedy was a cannabis user. You know, Google Kennedy and cannabis. There's some pretty convincing evidence that he was a cannabis user as well, you know. And I don't know, I think there's an important differentiation to be made between Jewish interests and Zionist interests. And, you know, I prefer to you know, if I'm going to condemn anything, my concerns are with the various aspects of Zionism, not Judaism itself. Per se, but the Zionist tendencies and agenda. And that's a very real thing that we can see taking place in the apartheid of Israel and the continual taking of land over there.
Yeah.
As well as American politics.
If marijuana was only used medicinally, you know, my dad, when he died, they gave him morphine. If maybe marijuana would help, but I am totally against marijuana as a recreational drug.
Well, that should be something you can only apply to yourself, you know. To try to apply that to somebody else's own free will, like myself, I'm a regular user of cannabis. I used cannabis today before this interview, in fact. To try and apply that is fascism in my mind, you know, trying to suppress the freedom of somebody else to use a natural plant that humanity has been using for tens of thousands of years is fascism.
Okay, Jeff. You had another question?
When you look at Mexico, yes. What about violence and IQ tied, the lowering of IQ and the raising of violence tied to marijuana use? I'll get off the air.
You only have drug gangs when you have prohibition. It's not got anything to do with legal cannabis. This is a product of the prohibition that people like yourself are promoting here. And the violence as well is a product of that prohibition. That's not something that's inherently known to involve cannabis. You can go to places where cannabis has been consumed for thousands of years, like India, and find very peaceful people like sadhus and yogis partaking of this herb, or Sufis in the Middle East that have used this cannabis sort of preparation for generations. So that's not inherently a cannabis problem. It's the result of prohibition, you know?
Right. Okay, Jeff, thank you for your phone call. All righty, let's take Sherry in Kansas. Sherry?
Hi, Deanna. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hey.
Good show. Very interesting. You know, Deanna, it struck me that I've got Jack Herrera's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And, you know, the main things they say in there, I haven't looked at it for a long time, but the DuPont and Hearst were mainly behind making it illegal. But I think, because didn't Reefer Madness come out in 37 And in 1938, the FDA came into existence. And I think it was also about getting it so it was illegal to use for medicine.
No, the FDA came into existence in 1906, I think.
Well, I know the report from, that report that Rockefeller was responsible for, but, maybe I'm thinking, well, I don't know why it struck me, but, you know, why wasn't it on the grass list? You know?
You know, it was on the grass list. A major medicine prior to 1937. At one time, I put together a museum collection of cannabis and other drug artifacts, and I collected cannabis medicine bottles from prior prohibition from the early 20th and late 19th century. And it's astounding how many medicines it was used. And it was like a common ingredient to cough medicines, a common ingredient for corns and bunions and other growths, a common ingredient in medicines for female complaints, and widely used, popular medicines of the time. And there were doctors arguing against the prohibition of cannabis when they brought in the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937, you know. And a lot of people didn't really realize what was taking place. They were more familiar to cannabis medicines under the name of cannabis and to hemp as hemp, you know. They didn't really realize this term marijuana, which is actually a Mexican term. Now, Anslinger didn't create the term marijuana, as a lot of people like to suggest. You can find the term marijuana in Mexican pharmacological lexicons going back to 1850. So it would be around quite a while, but English-speaking people in North America, they didn't recognize this term. A lot of them thought they were talking about local weed and other plants that were quite damaging. And so this really focused propaganda campaign, and a lot of racism was used as well. You know, it's important to remember the role of racism in cannabis prohibition and how it was taking place, because what was happening at the jazz clubs where cannabis was being consumed were blacks and whites were fraternizing for the first time, you know. And that's, I think, one of the effects of cannabis, is it can take you out of that sort of societal program tunnel vision reality that we're programmed into, and it can break you out of that momentarily. And so all of a sudden you can see the former demonized individual across the table from you as an actual human being. And that was one of the biggest effects of cannabis being consumed in the jazz clubs, was this making people in a sense colorblind in a very positive way. And that's why racism was used as a means of demonization, including foreign terms for cannabis such as marijuana, which were not widely recognized.
Well, and you could also grow your own medicine. So that's why they had to make it illegal.
Absolutely.
That's all I have. Thanks.
Grow your own medicine, grow your own food, grow your own clothes, and God bless Jack Herr. I knew Jack Herr personally. He wrote the foreword to my first book, Gringo, The Tree of Life, Marijuana, Magic, and Religion, called it the companion to his classic, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. A greater man I have not known.
Great. All righty. Well, we'll be going to a break momentarily. Yes, I do believe that I read his book. The Emperor Has No Clothes, and I have a huge book collection, and I also have a lot of Kindle and PDF files. Anyway, we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today has been Chris Bennett. He is the author of Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. And this easily could have been two books. This is really a very big, big book. And you've done a very good comprehensive review of so many things. You have illustrations in here. You have the bibliography, a wonderful index, and there's just you've left nothing out. It's fabulous.
Well, thanks. That's a really great compliment. My other books are all big books as well. I don't think I've written anything in my four books that's under 500 pages. And I actually had to pull a lot of stuff out of Libra 420 to get it down to that size. Initially, when I started on the project, I thought I would be lucky to get maybe a chapter out about the medieval and Renaissance material, because I didn't think there was that much on it. But as I began digging into it, there's not much written about that history of cannabis. As I began digging into it, that took over the whole book, and I thought the focus would really be on the 19th and 20th century occult use of cannabis, and I ended up having to condense that material down to a single chapter and pull out a large portion of that material regarding the 19th and 20th century occult use of cannabis, and now I'm working on another book that follows up on Libra 420 that details the use of cannabis and other drugs in the occult in the 19th and 20th century in more detail. And my other books, my earlier books, deal with the role of cannabis in the ancient world, which I was limited to about two chapters in Libra 420 to give some sort of background and origins for this later magical use. But there's so much to be said on the ancient use of cannabis. You could probably write a few books on the different areas that it was used and the different cultures that it was used by.
Indeed. Yes, I was going to say, so you've got material for your next book. And that's great to keep producing and terrific. There's so much in this book, honestly. It's just overwhelming, really overwhelming. And you've talked about the Illuminati, which we don't have time to talk about, but you've talked about that. You've talked about many, many things. And I love the illustrations. I think that it really adds something. A picture is worth a thousand words, as they say.
And yeah. You don't want to be too dry, and you know, it's important to document stuff, but if it's all just footnotes and references, it's a little hard for most people to make it through. You want to keep it interesting, and I always try to make sure I've got a few obscure facts on every page and some great illustrations to bring it all to life, because illustrations affect the right brain in a way that helps bring the left brain into tune with it, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, you have to appeal to both sides. And I really like the old pieces of art that you've used. Really great. Well, thank you so much. That went by fast.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you next week.